This is the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and hitting subscribe on your friend's phone without them knowing. Coming to you from the Kitchen Studios in downtown Raleigh. This episode is sponsored in part by Spot On, tech that helps your business grow. Request a demo at spoton.com. And Joe Van Gogh Coffee, serving the community from seed to cup, taking particular care at every step to honor the bean. And now conveniently heading to the toilet when the check comes. It's Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And today, we venture out to Tarboro. And why are we talking about Tarboro? Well, the very famous restaurant there called On the Square is turning 20 years old this year. That's right. And the owner creator, no, it's not Einy, the man behind Einy. He's a chef, he's a sommelier, but even more important than that to me, he's a Giants fan. He is Stephen Ribastello. Welcome, sir.
Hello, hello. How are y'all doing?
Doing great.
It's about time we've had you in the studio, right?
Well,
we can't get your wife to stop talking on all these mics, but I kid. But before we get to you and have you talk to us, I just want to give our listeners a little heads up of some of the episodes that are coming up, such as Larema Coffee, which is in the same shopping center, I believe, as Tarboro Tap and. I'm saying it wrong now. Your tacos place.
TBC West.
There we go. Because Larema Coffee is up there in Rocky Mount. And we'll have them on the show coming up very soon. We're also going to head out to Our State Magazine's NC Awards, where we'll be judges. We're going to judge people and things that they do. And then coming after soon, writer Eric Ginsburg, he'll be on, notably of Raleigh Magazine, but also the NNO and Food and Wine, Bon Appetit, some excellent.
He's everywhere.
Yeah, he writes a lot. And then we'll get into this a little bit later, but we have Chef Oscar Gnappi of, I don't know if I'm saying that right, Gnappi, maybe, of Coletta, which we'll talk about that later. But Matt and I just had the fortunate time to see Coletta, the restaurant, just open.
And Max, this is going to come up on a future episode, but we're going to go behind the scenes of a PGA Tour event for all you golfers fans to get into the F&B world of more of sports and golf. So a lot of good stuff coming up.
Yeah, watch out, Wright Thompson. We're coming for you, bro.
That's right, Wright.
Yeah, no. But anyhow, now it brings us back to here. And Stephen, you're here in studio. It's about time. We've known each other for years, and I would lean to say that you're a man of few words whenever we've met. You're kind of you're a quiet guy. You sit to the corner judging everybody. No, I'm just kidding. No. But you're a guy that knows his way around both the front and the back of a restaurant. You've been doing this for a while. Now it's your chance to finally tell your side of the story.
Well, I feel like my wife's told it already several times. She even wrote a book about it.
Yeah, but it hasn't been your words.
No, it hasn't.
But you know what? Even before we get into that, I just want to say, first of all, and transitioning for, even before we do our weekly sports update here, as we do on the, because it relates so well to a food and beverage show. No, but first of all, you spell your name correctly, Stephen with a PH, which is I spell my middle name. So for all you V Stevens out there, you know, go learn how to spell. Before we get into this, how many wins do the New York Giants have this year? We are speaking a couple days before the season starts. This is going to go on record, so
let's do the over-under at six.
That's exactly where I was going to go.
Over.
Over 6 wins?
Over six.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we got a shot at being slightly above average this year.
Slightly
above average. Okay. So
that's because you have an extra game in the season, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
That's where that one came from.
I'm going to go on record saying exactly at 6 wins.
Mm-hmm. Max, I think I'd agree with you.
Do you have a prediction for the Giants, or you want to just make a Raiders prediction right now?
No, I actually thought about the Giants, and I figured if Saquon stays healthy, you'll get 6 wins. And because Jones will probably, you know, run the opposite way into the end zone at least once this year. But aside from that, I think, I don't know. know. And Daboll, right?
Yeah.
Daboll, he's a real coach.
For sure.
All right. Enough talk. Raiders this year, though. I will be getting my Raiders tattoo when they win the Super Bowl. So
okay,
that's what happens.
Fair.
Set on the pod. It's going to happen.
Well,
all right.
Well, unfortunately for the tattoo shops in Tarboro, I'm not getting the Giants one this year because they're not going anywhere.
Although, I'll just leave it with the fact that every time when the Giants are not expected to do anything is typically when they have their best season. Well, so
at least we have what seems like a decent offensive line now for the first time in, you know, who knows how long.
Forever.
So
I'm going to segue with the Giants in this relevant conversation as to, I think this is how it went, but I want to fact check with you. Speaking about the Giants and speaking about your history prior to On the Square, of course, people that don't know Inez Rubistello or Steven Rubistello or the story and Life After Windows and all of that, we've got to kind of real quick crib notes it back up. But of course, the two of you were working at Windows of the World, the top of the World Trade Center. And there's an entire book about it. There's a podcast about it and a couple of episodes on our show about it. But you were not in the building on September 11th. And from what I remember, because it happened on a Tuesday, you were watching your horrible New York Giants get their butts kicked by the Denver Broncos on Monday Night Football. And I think you might have had one too many or had a good time and overslept and didn't make it to work that morning? Is that the story?
That's not entirely accurate. I was watching the Giants game with some buddies. I can't remember what the heck we were at, some Irish pub somewhere in Midtown. We ended up commiserating afterwards after another loss. I lived in Jersey City at the time, so I had to take a PATH train back to the city, and they left every half hour late at night. So I think I missed the 1 o'clock train trying to get down. I didn't get, then got through at 1:30. And then I wasn't doing the work till 11.
Okay.
So I got up in Jersey City at 10 o'clock, alarm goes off, and this is back when we had answering machines. Remember what those things are.
Mm. Yeah.
And, I wear contacts. I couldn't see a darn thing. I had my contacts in. And I walk over and I see the light blinking, and there's 27 messages.
Mm. Oh, man.
So our apartment in Jersey City looked at the Statue of Liberty. And then if you, stuck your head out the window and looked left, you could see the top, a little section of the towers, but nothing else because the skyline was blocked off by another building. And I stuck my head out and looked left, and it was just smoke.
Black smoke, yeah.
So. Wow. Just kind of center it all together. You were working there, from what I remember and from what I've read, you've always been involved in food and beverage, even as a young kid growing up in upstate New York, is that right?
Hudson Valley, yeah.
Hudson Valley, yeah. And then even went out to North Arizona for college, and you worked at a few different restaurants, but really, from the way I was watching your career trajectory, you were more front of the house. You were like a sommelier working on the floor. You were supposedly getting a job at Tavern on the Green, and that didn't happen when you finally got to New York.
Yes.
But I'd like to know, because obviously now in retrospect, having run On the Square for 20 years, you're the chef, you cook and you're a culinary guy, but you kind of started off in the front. So walk us through a little bit. What was 18-year-old Steven doing thinking about running beverage programs?
Well, my first job was at a fine dining, old school restaurant. And I was a busser and then a banquet waiter. Then my second job was at a restaurant that was opened up by two CIA grads, two younger guys at the time. And it was close to my house. And I went in and applied for a server position. And they gave it to me. And the one guy, they both taught me how to cook eventually. That's how I got into the kitchen mm-hmm. side of things. They needed help, earlier in the week, and I told them I'd work 2 days in the kitchen, but I wouldn't give up my weekend shifts, So I learned all the basics there, how to make stocks, how to butcher, all that kind of stuff. But the one chef, Louis, was a big wine guy, and he had been left this incredible cellar by his uncle. And so he would open wine and let me taste it. And, we were drinking incredible stuff like Petrus and Lafitte and stuff like that. Jeez. I had no idea. At the time I was like, man, this is pretty good.
We'll just go for $9.99.
Yeah, exactly. So, I cut my teeth on this stuff. I had no business drinking. And anyway, it sparked interest in wine. I kind of studied wine, from that point on. And when I moved out to Arizona.
When you say studied, just reading by yourself, finding publications and reading, or you weren't correct. Getting. You were getting hands-on education.
Hands-on in the restaurant, you're obviously around wine.
It's the best way.
Yeah, but, also reading. Spectator, Robert Parker, Jancis Robinson, all these, wine people. Well-respected wine people.
Yeah, authorities.
I got my hands, whatever I can get my hands on. And, I was going to school for engineering eventually, was in Northern Arizona and, just liked wine so much more than what I was studying in school. And I was at a resort in Sedona and had the opportunity to, become a part-time sommelier. And then in quick succession, the restaurant manager left and then the head sommelier at L'Auberge de Sedona at a young age. I was 22.
Wow.
When I first got that job.
That's nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then
and this wasn't just like your run-of-the-mill wine program. This is pretty serious wine program. I mean, I've been to that area in Sedona. Pink Jeep tours, by the way. Do they still do those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh,
those are amazing. Yeah. This was a significant list, I'm assuming, yeah?
Yeah, a French resort, 500 label wine list, best award of excellence with Spectator. So, yeah, it was a good list.
Yeah.
And we got to, do with it what we wanted to, which was great. No one really oversaw us. There was no wine people above us. So we had a lot of fun. And the guy that hired me there eventually moved to New York and opened the Russian Tea Room.
Okay.
And when that reopened, right around when Warner Leroy died. Anyway, I eventually moved back to New York and followed him. And I was thinking I was getting a job at Tavern on the Green. That all fell through. And so I was left in New York City with no job and very little prospect. And I remember I had a Where to Dine in New York City Wine Spectator edition. And I just started going to every restaurant on there. I met, David Gordon. I talked to him downtown.
David Gordon was Tribeca Tavern wine director at the time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And he remains a great friend. But at the time, he's like, yeah, I don't have anything but good luck. And I just got lucky. The timing was right at Windows. Walked in, nailed the interview. They didn't realize it was in over my head until I started. And then after about 2 or 3 months, everyone in the beverage department left and at Windows. And they hired Inez, my wife, back from Los Angeles to become my boss. So naturally, I started, dating her. So.
That's always.
Which is, you're not supposed to, right? Like you were supposed to, they frowned upon that, but you're like, well, we're kids, yeah.
Wait, why did everybody leave? Was Kevin there at the time, and then he left, so everyone kind of went with him, or why did the whole beverage team leave?
So Kevin was always there, but he didn't really do anything directly. He was just a figure, and he ran his wine school.
Okay, we're talking about Kevin Zarelli, who wrote the Windows on the World wine book, one of the best publications for those of you learning about wine.
If you want to learn about wine, get that book. It's one of the best things you can do to get started.
Yeah, and a quick plug for Kevin. It's the number one selling wine book in the world.
Yeah.
So. Oh, really? Wow.
So, is it in the world?
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive considering, because I've had this conversation with a lot of European wine professionals, and, they read Jancis Robinson and Hugh Johnson to start out, whereas, we read, Sotheby's book and Kevin Zarelli's book, at least I thought, but now it seems that that has changed as well.
Yeah, longevity alone, he's, been doing that, he's released that book for I don't know how many years.
It's got to be 30 years.
Yeah, something like that.
So. Yeah.
Anyway, he wasn't really actively participating. So why did the beverage team?
So Allison Junker, I think I got her name right. She was headed to Bordeaux to work in a winery.
Okay.
Ken Rosati, who lives in Durham, I think he still lives in Durham. I hadn't talked to him in a while, but he ended up leaving. I can't remember what the first step was, but he ended up opening up a distribution company in North Carolina called Centurba.
Okay.
Which is now Proof, run by Damon Haynes. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He's a good friend.
Yeah, yeah.
I email him weekly.
Yeah. So anyway, before Proof, Centurba was around, and Damon was like, Ken's right. Anyway, that's where Ken went.
Yeah.
And then Mark Coleman, the at the time the beverage director, went to work for Palander Imports.
Okay.
Yeah. So they all moved on to different wine, jobs, different parts of the industry. Mostly because the restaurant world, for a lot of people can suck. You work at nights, you work holidays. So, when you have kids, a lot of people want to kind of transition to something that has a more normal, routine. So.
Right on.
We know, and I don't mean to make light or gloss over such an impacting situation as I'm speaking of 9/11, but that, like, once 9/11 happened, obviously the job is gone, the building is gone. You lost a lot of people there, and you know, we've went through, your wife wrote the book, her memoir Towards It All, and the struggles that kind of happened after that. But for you, like, I know from the story that she's got, you know, that she goes back to North Carolina into Tarboro. Her father had said that you guys already had a trip planned to Bordeaux or to Burgundy, I think, during Crush. This would be, because obviously September 11th, you're talking about the beginning of fall, and then you're going to go like in October or so to Crush for the wine season. And he was just like, just go, just live your life, do this. Like, what was going on in your mind? I know that, like, she had this stuff kind of planned. Did you feel like you were going to continue in the restaurant industry? Did you feel like you were, like, what was next? Where were you at this point?
You know, I probably, if I had to, you know, go back in time and think about it, it's been a while, obviously. You know, I was probably in such utter shock. I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, I mean, it was, if you know anything about working in, like, the restaurant industry, you know, it's, you know, it can be pretty intense, but especially when you're working in Manhattan at a high profile place,
yeah,
you know, where, you know, I mean, you're working all the time, you know, it consumes you. Everything you do is kind of, you know, around your work schedule, and, you know, you're going to dinners and you're going to, like, you know, different tastings and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, like, light switch, it's all gone.
Yeah.
And it was just, and of course, you know, there's the loss too, the actual loss of friends and coworkers. So it was, and, you know, everyone deals with loss. Everyone, you know, has loss in their life, and, you know, there's tragedy, and, you know, but what you don't usually get is that much at once.
Yeah.
And that was the hard thing. And I think you just, you know, I kind of, like, blocked it off. Mm. Well, that's what I did. It was probably some defense mechanism, because I didn't know how the heck to process it.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, only years and years and years later did I understand some of this stuff from a psychological perspective. You know, if you get into, like, you know, DABDA and all the stages of, you know, dealing with something like that.
Wow.
And you try and figure out, and I've done it. I've gone, like, thought back and, like, you know, tried to figure out where was I at this point and where was I at this point, you know, as we moved on from 9/11. But so getting back to Burgundy, we had gotten an invite from Jeremy Sace at Domaine du Jacques, who shares my exact birthday, September 15th, 1975. Yeah. That's as much as you're getting on the personal information side, by the way.
Yeah. We'll get your routing number later.
He's a Virgo.
Yeah, he's a Virgo. But we had met him in New York City, and you know, he had, you know, said you should come out and work Harvest. And we're like, yeah, great, but, you know, there's no way we're getting away from the job. After 9/11, we ended up staying in the city for a little bit. I know he's got a job with you know, restaurant group. Yeah, opened up Bluefin in Times Square. You don't want to talk about the wrong move.
BR guest restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, they're a pretty big group. But, you know, shortly after 9/11, on New Year's Eve, we opened a restaurant in Times Square.
Yeah.
So it's just, like, you know, awful idea. And I got a job at a retail store called PJ Liquor Warehouse in Northern Manhattan. Big, massive place. Once we decided that, and it was pretty much, I know, you know, she said, you know, I got to get out of here. I need to get out of the city. That was in the spring. Then once we got back to Tarboro, that's when we contacted Jeremy and said, hey, offer still up?
Yeah.
So we ended up traveling to France and kind of zigzagged across the country, visiting, you know, different wine regions. Ended up in Provence, did a little harvest work at Rutas, and then ended up in mid-September at Dujac. Did harvest for a couple weeks there, which is miserable work, in case anyone's listening that thinks it's a good idea. Really, really not fun labor. And then went to Domaine de Trienne, also in Provence, in the Var, and did, like, vinification. Lived at a house in the vineyard there. Worked in the wine cellar. You know, learned that side of the, you know, winemaking, you know, industry.
I can just say that, speaking from the wine professional's perspective, that no matter what is going on in your life, I think, and, like, I think if even I was asked now, if Jeremy Sayes asked, hey, Matt, do you want to come work harvest at Dujac? Like, I think I would tell my wife and the kids and Max and be like, guys, I'm going to be gone for a little bit because I'm going to go work harvest. Like, it's hard work, but I mean, that's as prestigious as it can get. For reference, I mean, if you've heard about, it's, you know, there's DRC, Domaine de la Romanée Conti, which is probably the most famous, most sought-after wine in the world, and then close second is Dujac, obviously, as they're also related in some ways. And so that's pretty high praise to get the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and you want to hear something cool. My daughter, who just started college, on her own, and she went to high school in Durham at Science and Math, so she was already kind of away from us. But while on her own, contacted Jeremy and said, hey, I'm interested in working for you this summer, and got a job this summer.
No way.
And so spent this summer at Dujac, and went to like University of Dijon for like a 2-week immersion in French, and then spent like five weeks at the winery.
I'm jealous.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Cool, full circle kind of, you know.
Is this part of her passion, the food and wine and all? Is that?
No.
She just wanted to go to France.
She loves food. She loves food. And she likes, I mean, well, she's 18, so, but, you know, always let her taste wine. She, knowing that she was going to be going to college in New York City, she thought, well, if I need to get a restaurant job, this looks pretty good on my resume.
Mm.
Plus, going to France for the summer is kind of cool. So that was you know, the impetus for getting a job with Dujac.
And she got the job herself.
So she did.
Yeah.
We didn't even know about it. So
that's unbelievable. Yeah. All right. Uncle Jeremy, huh?
Yeah.
Coming through again. Yeah. So I definitely, you're here because we're celebrating 20 years on the square, and I want to get fast forward to that. Before we do, though, I need a coffee break.
Oh, yeah. We're drinking some delicious coffee tonight. Yeah, this is amazing. What we have here is from Joe Van Gogh. Our friends over at Joe Van Gogh, we're drinking the organic Mexican El Porvenir coffee. This is flavor notes of graham cracker, apricot, tamarind. This is a fair trade and USDA organic coffee with a medium to light roast. Give it a try. Give it a try. It's delicious. I mean, yeah. Thank you, Elizabeth, for Chemexing this coffee right now. But to learn more, get more information from Joe Van Gogh, go to joevangogh.com or check out any of their locations all throughout the triangle,
from yeah.
Hillsborough to Durham to Raleigh.
Yep. And speaking of wine, I'll just say Triangle Wine Company, guys, not only are they great for all your wine, beer, mixer needs.
Mm-hmm.
They have great tap rooms at their locations in Holly Springs, Cary, and Southern Pines. But also, they are starting to put together some super cool events, namely of which I am doing on the 17th of September, coming up soon.
Post Stephen Rubistello birthday party?
Stephen Rubistello, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In celebration, we are going to be doing a tour of Bordeaux and some. And Mookie's Deli is going to do all the meats and cheeses to pair with it, and I'll be doing a little seminar. So get your tickets, trianglewinecompany.com. Don't forget to use the NCFB promo code for a little bit of a discount.
That's awesome.
Mm, that's good coffee.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's tasty.
Yeah. But so, yeah, let's discuss on the square. So it's the 20-year anniversary. We're in 2022. So in 2002...
You get back from this whirlwind French trip.
Yeah. And then you decide to open a place. I mean, is this accurate in that, like, I believe the lady that owned on the square was already a restaurant that had been open before. And then the woman that owned it was selling it. And it was just kind of a thought, but didn't seem like a reality to both you and Inez at the time. But then while you were gone in France, you guys get informed by her father that he's like, no, I need you to stay here, and this is how I'm going to keep you here, is if you guys run this restaurant. Is that fairly accurate?
That's pretty accurate, yeah. So it was October in 2002, and mid to late October, and his dad, Rusty, who's a huge, you know, Tarboro fan, and wanted to, you know, develop something downtown that would make the town more attractive to people visiting, was pushing for us to have a restaurant. And anyway, he facilitated the purchase of On the Square, which at the time was a little breakfast and lunch sandwich shop.
Mm-hmm.
Had a smoking dining room, if you remember those things. Okay. When they existed, it was legal to smoke in restaurants.
Right. So weird, yeah.
And it's crazy to think about. We turned the smoking room into our wine cellar.
So, nice.
Yeah, so that became our wine cellar and office. And then we slowly kind of morphed the restaurant into what it is today.
But hold on a second. You're in France. You've been spending... on literally like on top of the world, windows of the world, drinking great Bordeaux and great Burgundy, and Rusty Holderness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is his name?
Yeah.
Says to you, you guys are coming back to Tarboro. I mean, France, New York City, Tarboro. It doesn't really add up at the time.
Well, I left one little piece out. When we left New York, we moved to Tarboro.
Okay.
And we stayed there until we left for France. That was for maybe like 3 months. Did like some consulting stuff. Did some, you know, private chef dinner things and stuff like that. Just, you know, idle, you know, time kind of stuff. Not anything serious. And then jumped into France. So, you know, we'd already looked around a little bit.
So it was already kind of percolating.
It was already percolating. Okay. Yeah. So.
And how did you, I mean, you can't even, at that time, there was no DirecTV, you know, Sunday Ticket. You can't watch Giants games in Tarboro.
No, I can't. I mean, when they were on TV, it was always a, you know, a highlight. In fact, one of my most memorable birthdays ever, Inez was, at this point, she was up in Atlantic City working at the Borgata, and I was in Tarboro by myself. And so Rusty and his wife, Marianne, had me over for dinner. And it was Monday night, and the Giants were playing, the Cowboys opening up the season. I think it was the Cowboys. He's like, what do you want for your birthday dinner? I was like, look, don't go to any trouble. He makes really good chicken wings on the grill. I was like, just do some grilled chicken wings. I walked in around 6 o'clock, and you know, there's a little smoke coming out of the grill, and they were in there preoccupied with stuff, doing bills or whatever the heck they were doing. They paid me very little attention, so I went to the fridge, got a glass of wine, sat down, and started watching pregame stuff. Well, about an hour later, I hear Marianne say, "Have you checked on the wings?" And so anyway, Rusty runs outside. He comes in covered in soot. There was a grease fire, and it had caught and carbonized the wings completely. Like, if you touch them, they just, like, dissipated.
Disintegrated. Yeah.
So he ran to KFC and got fried chicken wings from KFC and dipped them in this homemade sauce. They were terrible.
Same thing. Yeah, just as good. Just as good.
Yeah, so memorable birthday meal.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, like, and then Inez jumped out of a cake or something like that. No. She was home.
Yeah.
But, okay, so... So you were looking around Tarboro, and then on the square had the smoking room. And so you went full force with the idea of, like, let's open something of fine dining and a big – I mean, what was Tarboro even known for at the time?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, a small town. You know, Tarboro doesn't have a lot, but what we have is kind of nice. That's a good way to describe the town. And that's what it was like when we got there. There was a few shops. You know, it was a cute little downtown. The downtown area looked a lot better than some of these other Eastern North Carolina towns, so it had some, you know, vitality to it.
Okay.
It's the county seat, so you have, you know, lawyers and all the associated, you know, businesses with that. And then there's a medical community, so you have a lot of doctors.
Okay.
So there's enough interest in wine, and I think, you know, finer dining. I hate using fine dining, but you know what I mean. Just get the point across.
Yeah, elevated, a little more upscale. Dining.
Elevated, yeah, different ingredients, fresh fish, you know, things like that. You know, I gave him an 18-month commitment. I said, yeah, well, let's give it a try. And at the time, of course, you know, when you're younger like that, you know, you're full of energy and low on common sense, so you think this is a good idea.
Right.
And then 20 years later, you realize, man, what a mistake I made.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, yeah, I mean, like, how... Going back to the original question I was talking to you about, like, you were a front of the house person and you did learn some culinary, you had some culinary chops from the guys that you had worked with back as a kid, but to just take over the helm of a kitchen, just the logistics. I mean, how did you know how to make a menu, build a menu, build your inventories, put it all together? I don't see that part in your path where it's like, oh yeah, you also learned how to run a kitchen. I feel like that's not an easy task. How did you just jump into it?
Well, I think from working in the kitchens when I was young, and having that professional cooking kind of experience.
Yeah.
When you go into other restaurants, it's kind of, I was always talking to chefs and you kind of figure out how they run, you know, what their steps of, you know, service are, how you get from, you know, raw product to finished plate. And, you know, the dynamics of it. So you're kind of involved in that, and you can see it through a different lens, a clearer lens when you've done it. That was always something I was cognizant of as I went from restaurant to restaurant throughout, you know, my life. Also, at On the Square, we started with, so we were open for breakfast, you know, at first. And it was just breakfast and lunch. And then I got rid of breakfast pretty quickly. And then we started doing, like, you know, like tapas-style wine dinner, wine nights. And we did that on Thursday and Friday.
Hmm.
And then... So it allowed you to kind of grow into it a little bit. And plus, you were already taking an existing restaurant, so we kind of, you know, it was already running. So you kind of stepped in and then slowly implemented what you wanted to, you know, do on the menu side.
Yeah.
So it was easier to figure out that way because it wasn't like we started from boom, here's a square box, go ahead and fill it up.
Sure.
You know, we had a running restaurant and we got in there and Inez has a culinary degree, by the way. Mm. So although she's dangerous in the kitchen, lops her finger off, drop a knife through her foot, you know, so, but she's actually a pretty good cook.
Okay.
You know, between the two of us, I'm definitely more of a kitchen person and she's definitely more of a, you know, front person at this point in our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the short answer. I mean, we kind of grew into it, and it was easier to do because it was already running. It wasn't like, a total blank slate.
So like, what was the first dish you put on the menu?
Oh gosh. I have one of our old school servers, that doesn't work with us anymore. But she framed, an early menu and it was like, I don't even know what the font was, but it was some cheesy font, like cartoon or something like that.
Yeah.
And we had like five things listed. And I mean, you know, it was just random stuff. It was like whatever I could get together at the time, whatever,
Sure.
I didn't have any staff.
Yeah.
So.
It's kind of like now. It's like full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like now. But the early menus were like, we did like little lamb meatballs and, mini crab cakes and, things like that. I mean, little tapas style stuff. Mm-hmm. And then everyone wanted more plates. So we started incorporating entrees. Then eventually went to a full scale menu where it is now. But it was always trying to use as much stuff as we could find, in and around Tarboro. And then incorporating that onto the menu. And, obviously, highlighting something. Like, wheat locoche, they thought was, garbage. And I'm like, this is great. Are you kidding me? So, we'd go out and get that and season and do something with that. And, just kind of, incorporating more worldwide thinking on local ingredients.
Yeah. And you've been like positively received by the community for years. I know when I first moved out here, all like the culinary people in this area were like, oh, you got to get out to Tarboro. I'm like, what? They're like, there's this place called On the Square. And like the wine program is amazing. The food's amazing. It's like, you wouldn't expect that this small town would have this type of, status or this type of restaurant in its spot. But like, you were doing something different for the community. And it's almost like we've mentioned before, it's like a parallel of like what Vivian was doing out at Chef and the Farmer, being that she was from there and then went to New York, kind of cut her teeth up there and then came back and opened a restaurant. But you guys... With the parents bringing him back, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you guys had kind of laid that foundation even before. And yeah, it's wild to think that 20 years has gone by. You probably didn't have that on your path in the beginning. You were in New York, you were doing all this, and then now, boom, you're living in Tarboro. You have a few kids. Mm-hmm. Restaurant now. What's your mindset now? What's the state of the restaurant at this point?
Well, the restaurant's good. The past 2.5 years have been just one mess after another. I mean, it's been terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to run a restaurant through, COVID and then all the subsequent little, hurdles that we had to jump through when you had, you couldn't find, all of a sudden, we got started getting a little bit busier and then there was zero employees to be found.
Yep.
And then now we're with like, we had all the gaps in supply chain issues and things like that. And I mean, it's like everywhere you turn, it was like every week you had a new problem.
Yeah.
And that part was really frustrating. And then we get hit with inflation, which makes it near impossible to run a restaurant right now with the cost of it. And everyone knows this if they go to the grocery store. I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You go and you buy a few things and it's like, $60.
Yeah.
And, the price of everything across the board, not just food, has gone up tremendously. So we're hoping that at some point things just normalize.
Yeah.
And we get a little break and we get like a nice calm seas for a couple of years.
Yeah, Felicia just texted me this morning and said, how much money did you spend at the butcher's market over this weekend? So I made a brisket. It was like, felt like a car payment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it is what it is. I mean, as far as inflation goes, right? I mean, yeah, maybe it normalized a little bit because it's a shock right now, but the normalizing is going to be of us being, oh, that's what a brisket costs now. That's what a car payment costs now. That's what gas costs now. Like, I don't see that coming down, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think part of it is exactly what you said. You get used to it. But, at first you didn't know how to react to it from a restaurant operator side. Yeah. Like you didn't want to like knee jerk to start like, jacking up prices.
Yeah.
So you had to get creative a little bit in how you set up your menus. We've scaled our menu back a hair. you know, we did things that weren't real obvious to our diners, but, you know, on our end, you know, allowed us to be a little more effective, cost effective, and kind of, you know, balance, you know, the increase up.
And the one thing I have to imagine, because you guys have always been, correct me if I'm wrong, a wine shop as well. Like, you could buy wine retail there, which is one of the best parts about North Carolina ABC permitting. You know, it gets a lot of flack for being a control state on the liquor side. But the one great thing is that you can pretty much have that dual license for being on-premise and off-premise at the same time. I have to imagine that helps supplement a lot of cost through the pandemic, et cetera.
It did, and wine's pretty simple, you know. I mean, if you're as far as selling it, you know, not as far as the, you know, the beverage itself,
understanding
but,
it, yeah.
But you know, if the wine's $10 and you sell it for $15, it's pretty straightforward,
right?
If it goes to 12, you know, so those, that's easy to fix.
Yeah,
The food side, unfortunately, is a lot harder to fix, because yeah, then you got to factor in, you know, all of a sudden you've got kind of a set amount of cost and things like, you know, plastic wrap, you know, and toothpicks,
yeah,
and then they all double and triple, and yeah, exactly, and so it's hard. Like, you're getting hit from all different directions,
right?
So it's a lot harder to nail down where you need to be to make sure that you can sustain yourself.
Yeah, and we'll get into more of that later on in our current events portion of the podcast.
Yes,
but actually, so let's save that for then. And what I want to know more about is, like, getting back to this menu. And you kidded that, you know, 20 years ago, and now you look back, terrible idea. There's always some sense of truth in it, you know. But a couple of things. I want to know how the menu has changed, and if there are any staples that still have remained because they're just so popular. And, like, what is popular in what we think of as this small town of Tarboro, but yet you've maintained this elevated level of dining for 20 years. So, like, yeah, what are some of the staples of that menu, and what do the people of Tarboro love about the restaurant?
Yeah, we have some things that we're certainly known for, like our fried calamari, you know, appetizer is one of our more popular and talked about dishes. On the mundane but popular side, we have a petite filet mignon, which I took off the menu briefly because of the price of beef at one point, and had to immediately put back on.
caught some flack from the locals.
Yeah, caught some flack from our regulars. So,
but that's the great thing about a community restaurant, right? Like, there is that exchange.
Yeah, it's much different than what I was used to, you know, working in a town like Tarboro, where, you know, your customers are coming in, you know, every week.
Yeah.
And, you know them all. I mean, it's interesting, because you end up going to, like, a lot more funerals and weddings than you ever, you know, would imagine you go to, because you know everybody,
right?
Yeah. Intimately. And, you're all kind of neighbors, and you see each other every day. And we get people from out of town too, but, you know, we just have so many regulars. So the town really has been supportive over the years. We, you know, our lunch and our dinner are two very separate services, and the menus are wildly different. Lunch is more almost exclusively soup, salad, sandwich with a couple pasta dishes, and we'll run a few specials, like blue plate specials and things like that. And it's, you know, you order up front, we give you a number, you sit down, we'll bring your food out. It's more casual, plays to a different audience. Plays to the same audience at nighttime, but also is more affordable, so you can reach out, you know, your customer base gets a little wider, I would say. And then at night, we, go to full service, you know, tablecloths, you know, elevated, you know, steaks, chops, fish, things like that. Mm-hmm. But the menu changes every week, so, you know, it's always, you know, we try and keep it fresh. At this point, I've got kind of a template, and so we're, you know, filling in the spots and the template with different things each week, so it makes it easier to kind of, you know, get your head around. But you know, we don't typically have three small plates, and we typically have a couple salads. We typically have a soup. We have, you know, a shellfish or two, a couple fresh fish dishes, a couple steak or meat, you know, dishes, and that's how the menu kind of sets. And then it'll evolve with the seasons and what we have produce-wise from our, you know, local farms.
Yeah. Which is another interesting thing, because we're in, like, from what I hear from chefs and even bartenders and stuff, we're in kind of like a weird in-between right now, because we kind of want to go towards fall ingredients and stuff, but it's still hot in North Carolina. So it's like still, but all those summer things are ending. So what is like timely now?
I mean, I still have, you know, heirloom tomato. I just got a text from my Chauncey, my vegetable guy. Quick plug for him too. Why not?
Yeah.
Lake Valley Farm in Tarboro, Chauncey Leggett. Great stuff. Lots of fun little produce. It's made my life easier as a chef, so I've got one really good source for local ingredients.
There you go.
Instead of having to go, travel around to find everything. But right now, we still have heirloom tomatoes, kinds of cucumbers, summer squashes. So we hadn't, and then he's, on the last bit, I think I saw a couple fall squashes mixed in. So you're starting to see the transition, but we're still loaded with summer stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, still have okra, still have, cantaloupe, watermelon, and, so, yeah, I mean, realistically, you could say it's fall, but it's not weather-wise.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. No. I'm already faking it, though. I'm, drinking my pumpkin spice lattes, and I'm putting, pumpkins all around the house. The girls already put spider webs everywhere. We're like...
Somebody in my neighborhood already put up Halloween decorations. I was is ahead of the game.
We did it just because we're like, we want summer to be over now. And if we just have the mentality of it, I want fall. Fall's the best time of the year, man. I want it as much as possible because I also feel like fall is the shortest season in North Carolina. It's like you get it and you're just like, everything's perfect. Oh, and it's gone. Now it's winter and everything's cold. So I want to indulge as much as possible.
I don't know. I love summer. I never want summer to end.
Well, anyhow, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back for episode 2, where we're going to get more into some topical things, like some new restaurants opening out there in the Cary area and Fenton. We're going to talk about kitchens being green.
And rising wine prices and ingredients, yeah.
Yeah. And I want to know about that Mexican pizza at Taco Bell. What's the deal?
Oh.
But for those that want to eat at on the square, I assume, how do we accept reservations online? How do we do this?
Is there a special, one-time celebrate big gala or anything? Or is there anything to celebrate the 20 years that people can attend?
One of our former employees is doing this cool thing on Instagram and Facebook. If you get a chance, you check out our On the Square social media platforms. Every day is a former employee where they are now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and that's cool. Pretty cool. Because once they're kind of lined up, you can kind of go down the line and see them all. But
And that's just to follow you On the Square, Tarboro, or On the Square on Instagram?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instagram and Facebook. Yeah, so that's been kind of neat. I'm really bad at stuff like that. I just came up with that idea. And of course, it's a great idea, but it never would have occurred to me.
Okay.
So my only creative ability is with food. That's it. I mean, I can't sing. I can't draw. I'm not good with advertising, so very few talents. I decided to play the one or two I have, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Stay in your lane.
Yep.
Do it well. Well, I'll just say that, for those of you out there, you guys are the epitome. You have the American dream, and you guys have the North Carolina dream. They talk about big fish and small ponds and small, not that you were a small fish up in New York City. You were like a medium-sized fish up in New York City, but coming down to Tarboro, taking that restaurant and elevating it for 20 years, and then not to mention, obviously, Tarboro Brewing Company and the tap rooms that you have with the DBC West, tacos and taps and all that stuff. You guys have made the North Carolina dream come true. So, for those of you out there, go to Tarboro, go to On the Square, and you will eat and drink extremely well.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.